10-30600, In Re Exteen Marine Service. Mr. Scaldon?
Yes, Judge. John Scaldon. Good morning.
Scaldon?
Yes.
Good.
Your Honor's Counsel, Office of May Please the Court. I'm here on behalf of Marquette Transportation this morning, who is the petitioner in limitation. The matter at the trial court that led to the limitation filing involved the deckhand's entanglement with a mooring line prior to the departure from a fuel dock. And
the basically severed his foot, ankle, and foot from his leg.
It didn't sever it from his leg. He had a severe laceration to his leg, and he had a compound fracture. He did not lose the limb. He subsequently went through a series of surgeries that was provided by the vessel owner to reset the fracture and to replace the skin that had been damaged when the rope had entangled his calf. The appeal that we are raising here with you this morning, really we were asking to focus on three points. The first is a very technical issue, and that has to do with whether or not the six-month statute for notice on filing a concursus proceeding is jurisdictional in nature, or whether it's in fact a challenge to the defendant's right, the plaintiff's right, to maintain their cause of action. We are submitting that it is absolutely not a challenge to subject matter jurisdiction. Now, when you file a petition for limitation, the federal district court has admiralty jurisdiction because that is vested based on the connection to maritime activity and whether or not there is locality. But it is not a matter of whether or not you have met the six-month notice provision that is inherent in the statute. That takes us, therefore, out of a 12B1 analysis and would take us into a 12B6 or Rule 56 analysis. That would be then separate from the second point that we are raising, which is a discussion of what is the proper notice provision when a claimant files a challenge, any claimant files a motion to dismiss, and it is unspecified as to whether the court is going to consider it under 12B1 or 12B6 or Rule 56.
I'm not sure I quite follow that argument about jurisdiction. With regard to the time requirement for filing a limitation petition, what excuses you from not filing within that six-month period?
That goes directly to our third point, Judge.
And that
is whether or not you have a reasonable possibility of a claim exceeding the limitation fund. It is not a stark 6 month. Any claim you have six months.
Assume for the moment, I know you contend that you meet that standard, but if you did not, where are you?
If you haven't met that standard, then what you have is a prescribed cause of action,
right.
But the court has subject matter jurisdiction.
The only business the jurisdiction means here is how much evidence should have gone in before the judge made her decision, right?
That would be correct, Judge.
Judge can take evidence under 12B1, and the evidence can be developed under Rule 56, right? Either way.
Either way, but there's a very stark difference in how those two motions are determined. Under a 12B6 or a Rule 56 analysis, the defendant, the person who is opposing the motion, has to show that there are contested issues of fact which would merit a hearing.
Did you move for rehearing to offer more evidence of your lack of notice?
No, we did not move for. I don't believe that we moved for a rehearing, Judge.
What do you do with the statement in the Morania? I think it's in the Morania case. One of ours has adopted that. You know, this was an obviously painful injury. And a series of surgeries, as your client was aware at the time that you filed the limitation petition, mm-hmm. or leading up to that time, why didn't you have the duty to write to plaintiff's counsel and say, are you planning to go beyond the value of the barge here?
Well, I think the issue is that the is that you have no way of knowing during the onset of the medicals what exactly your exposure is going to be. And if I can come back to the point when we talk about an analysis of what is a reasonable possibility of a claim that exceeds the value of the vessel, so we are dealing with an inherently factual analysis. We are talking about a $750,000 limitation fund. We have a plethora of cases out there that have dealt with limitation funds that are zero or that may be very low. And we are talking about a lawsuit that has been filed within 17 days of the accident.
That ought to raise somebody's curiosity about what they're going after.
Sure.
It's got to be more than medical.
Yes, so. And what we did receive, the only objective evidence that we received from the plaintiffs that would tell us what the hard damages were, is they produced an economist report to us in October of 2009 that it showed that all future wage loss, all past wage loss, if the plaintiff proved his maximum case at trial, was $256,000. Weighed against a limitation, potential limitation fund of $750,000, taken into account further that cure is not subject to limitation. Maintenance and cure is not subject to limitation.
Right.
So the amount of money that we are spending on rehabilitation, both in the present and totally in the future, is not going to be included in the limitation fund.
Basically, it would have been non-economic damages,
lost wages. Yeah. For that, to understand that, you have to understand with some reasonable certainty what is the recovery going to be? What is the level of recovery going to be?
Reasonable possibility is the problem.
Yeah, reasonable possibility.
Certainty.
Exactly right. Reasonable probability. And there has not been a tremendous amount of analysis, but it has been very case-by-case based on what is reasonable possibility. But the caution that
why isn't a reasonable possibility to reach that when he had, at that time, over $265,000 in meds?
Yeah, I think I think there's an issue.
There is an issue there,
Judge, as to the timing of those medicals. You have to remember that we're talking about a case where the plaintiff had 3 years, if he wanted to, within which to file his lawsuit. 3 years is the prescriptive period for a Jones Act claim. Filed at 17 days. Those medicals, when the court considered it, was considered in June of the next year. And so you're talking about a total quantum of medicals. There's a point here, though, that I think is important for all of us concerned, and that's sort of the seductive argument that the amount of cure that you pay should be tied to the analysis of what your exposure is going to be in the case. We understand that a lot of times we try to equate those two things, but let me offer one cautionary point on taking that as a bright line rule, is that the amount of cure that you pay could very well be facilitating a no recovery or very limited recovery of damages, because you may be facilitating medical care that is in fact going to result in the person either making a full recovery or the person having a very limited inabilities in the future. So, and by like token, a ship owner could provide minimal cure and perhaps take a minor injury and cause it to be well accentuated.
Let me ask you a question. What prevented your client from filing a limitation petition 6 months after the injury?
There's certainly nothing that prevents.
I mean, there's no significant cost to doing that.
No, there is a significant cost to filing limitation petitions, and that's because you have to post. And three of the decisions that have been cited in our briefs talk about that, is that you have to post bond for your vessel, and bonds for your vessel cost money when you do them. And there's a significant cost in terms of
what's the cost?
About 2% per year is the cost of a bond.
2% of $750,000.
That's correct, Judge. And but there's attorney's fees costs that are involved.
$3,000.
No,
2%. Well. $6,000.
I'll work on that in my head. I'll tell you this, that. When you file separate limitation proceedings and when you've got a state court action, what you are doing is creating duplicate proceedings at that point. And that would be very close to the hard out-of-pocket cost per year when you file for limitation.
That also includes attorney's fees to try a case worth $3 million.
Well, it also involves the attorney's fees of having to do it, of having to go and bring those actions. In what we are coming back to, Judge, is the standard one of whether we have to evaluate the worst case.
How does this play out? The defendant lays back and doesn't doesn't file a limitation petition so as to save $10,000 or $15,000 bond fee. Now, I'm not sure what that, something in that little range. And the plaintiff goes forward without any invocation of limitations facing them to the vessel, tries the case, goes tries it to verdict, and wins the case and wins a very large verdict. And then you say, "Oops, no, that's King's X limitation."
No, I think what you're describing, Judge, would be a factual scenario where the notice would have been quite different than what we're dealing with here. Here we're talking about, and if we frame it with, I'm sorry, I can't talk without my hands, I apologize. If we frame it within the context of this case, we are talking, one, about a fairly high limitation fund at $750,000. We are talking about a limitation that was filed 8.5 months, not years later, not 4 years later, not 2 years later. It was filed 8.5 months later, where the lawsuit, 8.5 months after service, where the lawsuit is filed 17 days after the accident, and where the medicals are ongoing. And the defendant filed that limitation in response to very objective events. It had, one, received an economist report that was well under the projection of any future wage loss, was well under the limitation fund. It then received a report from the plaintiff's treating physician that indicated a new course of treatment that was going to be undertaken for the knee that was separate from the fracture. It also received in December of 2009 an IME report from Dr. Sassard, which is also listed in our brief, that says, "I concur, we have not done any treatment on the knee. We've not done any treatment on the knee, and we are going to have to." And then the defendant in the action initiates a limitation proceeding in January. But what you have, this is not a defendant who you'd use the phrase, lays back and decides to wait for a trial and wants to see what the outcome is happening. This is a limitation plaintiff or a defendant in the state court proceeding who is dealing with ongoing and evolving medical case that makes a decision within a very short time frame, within 8 months, that this case is developing in a nature where it has to, it's going to make the decision to go ahead and proceed with a limitation.
Well, the district court, I perhaps don't understand this record. The district court said that Jackson's state court complaint explained the details of the incident, that the Jackson's petition attached and cited deposition testimony from an eyewitness who described, quote, in graphic terms, the nature and severity, et cetera, it goes on, and that extensive surgery would be needed, the recovery would be prolonged, these are quotes, the pain would be severe and prolonged and permanent. And they found they had already paid $265,000 for 5 major surgeries at the time it filed its claim.
At the time limitation had been filed, that was not at the time that they had filed the lawsuit, which is what the court is referring to, is an amount of money that that plaintiff's counsel or the claimant's counsel on limitation referred to in oral argument, that they've spent $260,000 in medical. That was a statement that he made when the court heard that in June of 2010. Now, that's not the amount of money that anybody had spent when the lawsuit was first filed against them 17 days after
what
the accident
by
had
December?
Happened. By December, medical costs, I don't have the medical costs broken out of my head, but they were, medical costs were building, and in December, we had received a IME report that tells us, oh, we've got a whole new course of treatment that's going to happen here. The point that I'm cautioning against is a difference between understanding what is a reasonable possibility and having to evaluate a case on its worst case scenario. If the standard out there is that we have to evaluate personal injury cases filed in state court immediately on a worst case scenario, what could go wrong? Where could these medical goes when it is unresolved? The invitation is that we would have to file limitation in every single state court personal injury action that's done.
What you looked at, you said, well, we looked at, you surveyed the, and I'm not being critical of this, but what you did was that you surveyed the damage award, but what you were asking was that what's the amounts of the larger recoveries for a broken ankle that where hardware has been used. Now, that doesn't quite get to this injury. This fellow had a line jerked around his ankle, and then it cut it in two, as I read the fact. And that's a very different than just saying a broken ankle that uses some hardware.
Yeah. We have a case where he has a severe cut. He's not broken into and it's not severed, and we've had other cases where lines have actually resulted in a severing of the leg and you have an amputation. We didn't have that here. What we have is we have a severe laceration with a compound fracture, and how that is going to resolve is going to be there is a range of results that can happen there, but you're not going to know immediately off the bat. Is this person going to have complications that are going to arise out of this that are going to be more than what you could anticipate at the beginning?
Well, their current demand, has the case been tried in state court?
Yes, the case was tried in state court. It is on appeal now in state court.
I'm sorry, did you?
It has been tried in the state court system.
And what was the return on it?
It was a $4 million verdict, roughly, of which $260,000 was, I see that I'm out of time, but $260,000 was the wages. All the rest of it was a result of future impairment or past impairment, again, all entirely dependent upon what was the result that was going to happen from the medicals, what was the result that was going to happen from unresolved medicals that were ongoing at the time.
What was the earnings of this party when the time?
The court adopted the plaintiff's economist report.
I'm sorry?
The court adopted in full the plaintiff's economist report. And found that the total quantum of past lost wages and future lost wages was $262,000, okay, which is the report that we had received in October.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, sir. We have time for rebuttal. Mr. O'Neill.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And may it please the court, I'm Jack O'Neill, and I represent the appellee. We believe that Judge Rosenthal ought to be affirmed in this case for four reasons. The first three reasons I can discuss quickly. The fourth reason is the reason I'd like to spend more time on. The first reason is that it's clear under the authorities from this circuit and other circuits, I think, that a limitation of liability action is an action to be strictly construed. The time limits are to be strictly construed. Even where there's this so-called underlying admiralty jurisdiction, we believe the law is clear that if a limitation action is not timely filed within 6 months, it must be dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, let me ask you about this rigorous rule. Under our case law that talks about reasonable possibility or adoption of Second Circuit case law.
Your Honor, I'm sorry to interrupt.
The reasonable possibility issue.
I'm sorry, it's the acoustics or something I'm having trouble hearing.
I understand.
I apologize.
The case law that talks about reasonable possibility, I'm trying to figure out how you interpret this case law on the 6 months. If we accept what the appellant is arguing, that for some period of time they would not have been on notice just from the complaint in state court of how serious this might become. And over time, a lot of what Judge Rosenthal relied on, they would not have known in the first several months. Is it your interpretation that the 6 months begins once there is something on which to base a reasonable possibility? Or, as I understand the case law, is talking about 6 months to investigate what's going on. What's the correlation between the 6 months beginning, or the connection between the beginning of the 6 months and the knowledge sufficient to form this view that there's a reasonable possibility?
Your Honor, I believe under the Morania Barge opinion, which Judge Jones alluded to, that even when doubt exists, the owner is not excused from satisfying the time bar, and I believe the Morania Barge opinion is critical in this case because once an owner receives a notice of claim, particularly the type of notice of claim we're dealing with here, which Judge Rosenthal interpreted to be the plaintiff's original petition in the state court action, which was filed on April the 28th of 2009, she went to that petition because that petition alleged permanent disability, permanent disfigurement, permanent loss of earning capacity. Once an owner is in possession of a notice like that, then the burden shifts, so to speak, to the owner to investigate. And that's what the Morania Barge opinion held. After receipt of a notice of claim, the owner must make the plaintiff define his position. The burden is on the owner, after receiving that type of notice, to do an investigation to find out whether or not the owner may be dealing with a claim that is subject to limitation. In other words, a claim that might exceed the value of the vessel. And my view of this particular case is that that's critical in this case, and that this opinion is very fact-driven and fact-specific. And I think what this opinion turned on, and I think what was probably very important to Judge Rosenthal, was that duty to investigate and the inexplainable, complete lack of any investigation after receiving that petition. I've prepared a little timeline for myself when I was preparing to come over here and argue the case. And the petition, Judge Southwick, was filed in the case on February the 28th of 2009. It was served on April the 28th of 2009. Now, that's the date Judge Rosenthal chose. It was the date the petition was served on the owner. April the 28th of 2009. 6 months from that would have been October the 28th of 2009. Now, with this duty to investigate, this, and this is not just in the Moriana Barge opinion, it's in other opinions too, even emanating out of this circuit, where there is this duty to investigate. And incidentally, the Moriana Barge opinion is the one that quotes Judge Learned Hand's opinion in the Spooner case, where Judge Hand is saying, well, let's really take a look at what is going on in these limitation cases. You can't. The Limitation of Liability Act is a special privilege that's afforded to ship owners. It's the ship owner is the only defendant in these kind of cases which can avail itself of this limitation of liability. So having extended this privilege to these ship owners, the statute is strictly construed, and once the ship owner receives notice, it must affirmatively and proactively act to investigate whether or not the claim may be subject to limitation. Judge Learned Hand discusses that, and then Judge Hand says, but wait a minute, he says in Spooner, you can't just take every single notice as triggering that duty to investigate, because the ship owner has to either tender the vessel or tender security for the vessel, and 99% of the time they tender security for the vessel. So what Judge Hand did was, in the Spooner case, he struck a balance, and he said, once a notice is received, there has to be an investigation of it. As a matter of fact, Judge Hand even went on, was stronger than that. He said, on the other hand, it is indeed reasonable to require him to make the claimant define his position. Now, with that in mind, if I can get back to my timeline and we can see what really drove this case, I think. So the petition was served on April the 28th of 2009. 6 months later would have been October the 28th of 2009. What was it that the ship owner did? The ship owner did one thing. The ship owner sent a set of interrogatories and a request for production of documents. And remarkably, in that set of interrogatories, the ship owner did not ask the plaintiff to state the value of his claim. Did not ask the plaintiff, what is the maximum value of your claim? Those of us who practice in Texas are very familiar with, and this court can certainly take notice of, Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 47. Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 47 requires, it mandates, that when a plaintiff files a lawsuit, that the plaintiff shall not specify the exact amount of damages. But then it goes on to say that the defendant, upon the filing of a special exception, and a special exception is two sentences long. It's an eighth of a page. And under Rule 47, if a defendant files a special exception to a plaintiff's petition that fails to specify the amount of damages, Rule 47 is mandatory. Rule 47 says, confronted with a special exception against your petition, which Rule 47 says in which you cannot specify the amount of your damages. Once you get a special exception to it, you shall specify, and what does the rule say? The maximum amount you are claiming. It is routine in Texas to file special exceptions. I remember I'm practicing a fairly long time, and I remember when Rule 47
only one
was
year longer than me.
Just barely longer, Your Honor. I remember when Rule 47 was initially promulgated, I thought, now why in the world, and I still don't understand, why in the world would the rules say when you file a case, you shall not specify your damages. You shall just say it's in excess of or it's within the minimum jurisdictional limits of the court. And why would this rule then say that's what the plaintiff shall do, and then the defendant has to specially accept to it. But that's the way it is, and that's been the way it is for, I guess, 15 or 20 years. And the issue here, of course, is whether or not the claim was subject to limitation. That's exactly what Rule 47 would have told the shipowner. Plaintiff files, plaintiff cannot say what its damages are. The defendant files a special exception, the trial court has no discretion. The trial court shall make the plaintiff specify the maximum amount sought. These interrogatories that were sent out by the ship owner that failed to ask the plaintiff to specify the amount of his claim, and once again, these interrogatories were sent out by a ship owner confronted with a petition that claimed permanent disability, permanent disfigurement, permanent loss of earning capacity. The interrogatories did not ask for the maximum amount of the claim, and certainly the interrogatories could have, and if the interrogatories had asked for that, and if the defendant had tried, if the plaintiff had tried to be evasive in its answers or pull some monkey business about trying to evade stating in the answer to the interrogatory what his maximum claim was, then all the defendant would have had to have done was to have filed a special exception. But these interrogatory answer, these in the answers to interrogatories, the plaintiff furnished the names of its hospitals and doctors, and then the plaintiff added an additional claim in answers to the interrogatories and said, I can't walk. All right. Now, those answers to interrogatories were served on July the 8th of 2009. So we have the petition filed on February the 28th of 2009, but it wasn't served until April the 28th of 2009. Judge Rosenthal used the date of the service of the petition as commencing the six-month period. That went to October the 28th of 2009. Interrogatories were sent out. That was the only investigation that was done. The interrogatories didn't ask the plaintiff to specify the amount of its claim. The answers to the interrogatories came back on July the 8th of 2009. So let's give the owner the benefit of the doubt here. Let's not start this limitation period running on the date it received the petition. Let's start the limitation period running on July the 8th of 2009, when the limitation owner when the owner got the answers to the interrogatories, identifying the hospitals, identifying the doctors, and saying, I can't walk. Then,
well, let me ask, if you start the 6 months there, is that consistent with the case law? I guess that was the question that you have been so helpfully answering. I don't know if we should read it that way. It seems to me they have 6 months to create, to investigate, and determine if there's a reasonable possibility. Does any case law say you can actually start the date later than either service or filing and start when they receive this knowledge of a reasonable possibility?
No, Your Honor. It should start. I think Judge Rosenthal was correct. I think the six-month period should begin when the owner receives written notice of the claim, and the way the cases have interpreted that is it's when the owner receives a notice that presents a reasonable possibility that the claim is subject to limitation. What Judge Rosenthal found in this case was that because of the allegations contained in the petition, a permanent disability, permanent disfigurement, permanent loss of earning capacity, she chose to start it then. What I'm suggesting to the court is that even if we start it later than that, they still fail to meet, to file the limitation petition within 6 months of the time they got the answers to interrogatories back. As a matter of fact, they waited, they got the answers to the interrogatories back on July the 8th of 2009. 6 months from then would have been January the 8th of 2010. They didn't even file then. They waited until January the 18th of 2010, which, by the way, Your Honor, was, in my view, contrary to what the case law amply says would be violative of the spirit of the limitation of liability action, because the case law is you shall not wait until shortly before trial of a case to file your limitation action. And they filed 28 days before the trial, before this case was set for trial. And so what you have is a situation where you have service of this case, of this petition on April the 28th, and all this time going forward with virtually no investigation taking place, and then, boom, 28 days before trial, this limitation of liability action is laid on this plaintiff. The other thing that struck me when I was looking at what had happened here and timed it out was the plaintiff in this case, Mr. Jackson, filed a motion to dismiss the limitation action as untimely, and then filed an amended motion to dismiss the limitation action as untimely. The amended motion to dismiss the limitation action as untimely had extraneous evidence with it. I mean, it had evidence with it, and was therefore, it was clearly not a real 12B6 motion. On its face, it was not a, let me back up a minute. I think I may have gotten my times wrong. There were two motions to dismiss that Mr. Jackson filed, the appellee filed, to dismiss this limitation of liability action as untimely. Both of them were kind of mirror images of one another. The first was a motion to dismiss, and then there was an amended motion to dismiss. When I was reading the appellant's brief in the case, I noticed a statement, a section of the brief that said, well, we, the appellant, got that amended motion to dismiss, but we didn't treat it as a Rule 12B1 motion. We chose to respond to it as a 12B6 motion. And they say the reason that they didn't treat it as a Rule 12B1 motion is because this motion to dismiss that the appellee filed on grounds of timeliness did not address the underlying admiralty jurisdiction of the court. Well, so the appellant chose to treat my client's motion to dismiss on grounds of timeliness not as a 12B1 motion, but as a 12B6 motion. Well, it was not a 12B6 motion, plainly on its face. It did not rely on the pleadings. Number two, it attached evidence to it. And as this court knows, the consideration of evidence outside of the pleadings converts that motion into a 12B1 motion. So it struck me as very unusual that because in this circuit, a motion to dismiss a limitation action as untimely goes to subject matter jurisdiction. Because in this circuit, if a limitation of liability action is untimely, that action shall be dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Because this amended motion to dismiss plainly on its face was not a Rule 12B6 motion, and further, because it attached evidence out and was relying on evidence outside of the pleadings and was therefore could not have been a Rule 12B6 motion, and because Judge Rosenthal obviously had discretion to consider it under Rule 12B1, why in the world when the appellant had every opportunity to treat it and address it as a Rule 12b1 motion, why didn't they do so, especially in view of this circuit's opinion in the Patterson versus Weinberger case that Judge Tom Clark wrote, where he held that once a factual attack on jurisdiction is made, the burden is on the plaintiff in the case, which would have been Eckstein here, to establish by a preponderance of the evidence that the court has jurisdiction. But that's not what happened here. What happened was just the opposite. They got this motion to dismiss, which was plainly not a Rule 12b6 motion, and because they had a flawed view that a limitation action, if untimely, cannot be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction because there's this underlying admiralty jurisdiction, they consciously made the decision not to even address it as a 12b1 motion. I see that my time is almost up. I do not want to sit down without offering to answer any further questions that the court may have. We respectfully ask that Judge Rosenthal be affirmed.
My only question is, you're not on the briefs. I assume you're properly retained.
Your Honor, I was retained 2 months ago in this matter. I did not participate in the trial of this. I have a very close friend who's here in the courtroom, Mr. John Schwambach. I've known John for many, many years. John was involved in this matter and called me 2.5 months ago and asked if I would get involved in it.
Smart move.
Thank
we
you.
Respectfully ask that Judge Rosenthal be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Chaldone.
Thank you. I'll try to take counsel's comments in reverse order, if I may. The petitioner's response to the motion to dismiss addressed the fact to the court that it could not be a 12b1 motion. The court addressed in its opinion whether, did an analysis of whether it would be a 12b1, b6, or a Rule 56 motion. That was because their motion was unspecified. However, the point is that the claimant cannot challenge subject matter jurisdiction of a limitation proceeding based on the notice provision in the statute. We cited it without having to go through all of those for you today at footnote 66 of our brief. We cited a list of maybe close to 20 cases that have held that the Limitation of Liability Act does not confer jurisdiction. It doesn't confer jurisdiction. That is conferred by 1333, and it is conferred by the U.S. Constitution.
But there's a Fifth Circuit case that says that the 6 month is jurisdictional, isn't there?
But it uses the word jurisdictional in dicta. None of those cases that have analyzed it, and we've discussed it in detail in our brief, have ever gone through the analysis of deciding where the original subject matter jurisdiction came from. I believe if you look at those cases, you will see two distinctions in them. One of them, and I don't want to. If you were asking me a question, I didn't want to interrupt you.
I don't want to get you off track of whatever else you have to say.
So one of them was one of the lines of cases that you will find is where the court is determining the 6 month limitation, right? But it is also engaging in an actual fundamental analysis of admiralty jurisdiction because there is a question of situs or there's a question of vessel status, both of which would determine whether there was underlying admiralty jurisdiction. And the second is that the courts are often referring to jurisdiction to maintain a stay order. In other words, their jurisdiction, their loss of jurisdiction to prevent the state court from moving forward. They're not referring to whether or not they have subject matter jurisdiction, original subject matter jurisdiction of the case. If we compare that with the case law that we cited that is settled, you find it is impossible for the Limitation of Liability Act itself to confer jurisdiction on the court. Therefore, the limitation period under it cannot be a subject matter challenge to the court. Okay. When the that being the case, if the court has to treat the motion under 12b6 or Rule 56, there's a vastly different standard to the opposition. In one, we simply have to show contested issues of fact, and the other, those are resolved for you. Moving to the issue of was this untimely in terms of the limitation petition being filed 28 days ahead of trial, that is a product of the speed by which cases get set in the Texas state court system. And in reality, that is, you have to take a look that we are still dealing with 8.5 months.
What precisely do you want, would you have this court do?
I believe that that there should be a factual, a hearing to make a factual determination, a full factual determination on notice that you cannot do that on a 12B1 motion. That is that at the end of the day, the noticed issue is highly factual in nature.
You want Judge Rosenthal to tell you that again?
I'm sorry. Well, I'd like the opportunity to show Judge Rosenthal the full list of starting with the beginning of the medical so that she can, and coming all the way through to the date that we filed the limitation and put the treating physicians on the stand and ask them, what did you know in March? What did you know in April? What could you have told us was a reasonable possibility of recovery? Quite certain, based on my knowledge, that one, they had optimistic views of how the skin wound was healing and how the care was taking and how the fusion was coming, and that they wouldn't have been able to tell you with reasonable certainty what was going to be the outcome of whether he was going to make a complete recovery and regain his mobility or whether he was going to have complications from that.
The opposing counsel made is that it is your obligation, I think, under the case law to pursue this during the six-month period. I don't know if anything gets told or not, depending on this reasonable possibility question. But it does seem to me that there wasn't much vigor on the part of your client to pursue this in that first 6 months.
They have actually, the obligation really stems in principal part from their cure obligation. They have an obligation to diligently investigate for maintenance and cure purposes. And this is a company that spent $260,000 on cure, meaning that they were diligently involved in the provision of medical care. And this is a company that had ordered an IME, meaning they had asked an independent doctor to take a look and tell them what the projection was in the future, and they filed their limitation proceeding very quickly after receiving that IME report. My last and final point, I'm out of time, would simply be that you had asked about whether it's a tolling period or whether it begins. It cannot be an absolute six-month time frame because there are cases that have said have allowed limitations to be filed 4.5 years later. After the filing, developments can change. You cannot isolate the ship owner to what happens within a six-month time period because the reality is that cases and their developments can change outside of that six-month time frame, and there would be no way for a vessel owner to have the reasonable notice. Thank you, John.
All right, thank you, sir. Court will stand in recess for 5 or 10 minutes.